Chinese and some of the South Asian scholars who've struggled with this, right? What is Mill's reason here? Because he's not one of these philosophers who just has unexplained quirks that he can't justify. He's totally the guy who lives by his own principles, right? If anybody is. So you've got to really think, what's the justification? And one idea that seems to be in the background to what Mill's up to is this idea of how fragile civilization is, the kind that he values, and his commitment to Plato and Socrates. And particularly, I think, also the value that he puts on literacy. He doesn't really know much about non-literate societies. He doesn't know the kind of anthropology we'd study today, where you can learn about the depth of oral culture and the way that oral cultures are able to maintain legal and political systems that are really complex and that are transmitted through generations by very sophisticated means. None of that is really understood. And he tends to think that literacy changes the game in terms of making refined political thought possible. He has his very crude ideas about what he'd call them primitive societies. He just uses that language unapologetically. What they're like, he's very influenced by a contemporary anthropologist called Henry Sumner Maine, who's got this idea that there are certain stages of progress in civilizations. They have to go through these steps, and you can look at contemporary, quote, primitive societies and see them in terms of the history of European societies. So he's sort of thinking of a kind of an earlier level of development of civilization, which is kind of some mishmash of what they know about early European societies, say the Germanic tribes, and imposing that onto the society of India and the village communities that are now starting to be understood somewhat better, at least that they're becoming an object of study. But this is all a bit muddled. It's based on some ideas that are not very well developed and that contain some just mistakes, right? The idea that there's one story about progress and that it's linear and that you need to have literacy in order to have political systems, and that people in pre-literate societies are selfish individualists. That's kind of the view he holds, and that there's a kind of cooperation that's only possible in these, quote, more advanced civilizations. So he's got a lot of basic anthropological errors going on there.
I'm reminded it's super interesting because obviously in many ways Mill was, you know, I think we can look back and say in many ways he was a genius, or at least an incredibly smart person and very forward thinking in many ways. And yet there's these obvious, and I like how you put these anthropological mistakes. And it reminds me of another kind of classic British imperial mistake of this, which was Captain Cook's, you know, the famous, you know, explorer and cartographer from the 18th century, you know, his, connection with the Polynesians, and, you know, Polynesian society spread across the Pacific, you know, the vastest area of the globe, and did so through very, you know, as we understand now, quite advanced, but very different ways of, you know, of navigation. But it seemed like, at least from what I know about this, of this story, the British imperial, you know, explorers of the time could not fathom that this was possible, that they had, you know, because they were illiterate, because they didn't organize themselves in the way that, you know, Europeans were used to, because they didn't, you know, convey media and information in the same sort of way, that they couldn't possibly navigate the Pacific on their own, you know, in a meaningful, directed, and effective way, which was, you know, we obviously know now is the case. They were more than capable of doing that. But, you know, this sort of these, what was valued by these, you know, imperial and European explorers at the time, you know, precluded the possibility of them understanding that.
Yeah, and that confusion between a certain kind of technology and a certain kind of moral or political or social development is really critical, right? You still see it in some instances in Canadian colonial history, right? For instance, the one of the famous cases to come out of BC Indigenous law, the what's called the Dalgamou case, is a classic instance here where a judge looking at Indigenous First Nations societies through the lens of Eurocentric notions of what counted as civilization was looking for a certain kind of technology in order to, and a certain kind of visible structure in order to think that there are political and legal institutions in First Nations communities, and completely missed what was there because he's looking through a certain set of expectations that's based on European technology, European history, and the way that that unfolded. So yeah, I think absolutely that these kind of anthropological errors are big there. But also related to views about what it takes to have virtues, where these narratives are anchored and what kind of society is needed to support them.
What is it more specifically about these virtues that makes them toxic, that turns them from being what we would think of normally as virtues to things that we look back on and kind of cringe or this was clearly wrong, immoral, or, you know, blameworthy in some sort of way, but yet, like, they were not obviously not viewed that way back then, right? So there's this kind of toxic virtue thing. Like, what makes them toxic, I guess, is the question.
Right. Yes. Yeah, and that's interesting because I'm not going to define toxic. I'm going to take it as a given that we're all on board with the notion that there is something wrong about denying self-governance to a country that you're ruling, right? The society itself came to recognize that there are some problems there. So for instance, with Mill, he's got this notion of cultured refinement. It's something he cherishes, and he only sees it in the form that he's familiar with. He's never been to India. His father wrote an incredibly prejudiced history of India that I don't think Mill ever completely recovered from, even though he threw off some of his father's views. I don't think he threw off enough of them. He's relying on some rather tainted sources, right? He's relying on reports from the civil servants or the East India Company employees to report back to him on what it's like in India. And so he's not exactly getting unprejudiced information. So I think this notion of refinement that he's cherishing, and this leads him to think that you only find it in one kind of culture, and it gives him a certain kind of blindness. Another example, for instance, Tennyson, I think he's one of the most famous poets of the day. He's a poet laureate, and he writes this famous poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade. You may have heard of it. Yeah, good, great. So it's talking about this military disaster when there was a mistake. There was a misunderstanding about an order, and about 700 cavalry were ordered to charge down directly into a barrage of cannons in this basically death trap. And something like 2/3, 3/4 of them were killed. And it was just a mistake. The leadership were quarreling, they were incompetent, they were trigger happy in the worst sort of way. People who should never have been in charge were the officers of the day, because at the time they had this system called the purchase system, where the aristocracy could buy their way into the officer ranks. It was a public relations disaster. The entire war was a mess. Soldiers were dying by the tens of thousands from hunger and cold and disease, even more than from battle. The battle itself probably should never have happened. The entire logistics and administration of the army was shown to be a disaster. And it probably would have led to some real change, except that Tennyson wrote this poem, celebrated the disaster, and he celebrated the fact that the cavalry didn't ask questions. There's not to reason why, there's but to do or die. Into the valley of death rode the 600. So he's making a virtue of unquestioned obedience. So this is a guy who's reviving chivalry, right? He's bringing the Arthurian legends back into fashion. They'd gone out completely. And he's telling a story where instead of being independent knights striving for honor, they're part of a military structure, a hierarchical authoritarian military structure, where their job is not to reason why. And that's making a virtue of this unquestioned obedience. If you think about the idea of war crimes, right, not to mention the poor decision-making because of the lack of information and perspectives that's not being shared because of this culture of unquestioned obedience, I think this is a really toxic virtue. People love the poem. It turned around, I think, the public sentiment that something was going badly wrong. It reaffirmed the role of the aristocracy. It stopped the Lord Cardigan, the guy who led the charge, from being prosecuted. But I think more importantly, it contributed to this culture where it was not okay for anybody in the military to question orders. And I give an example of how this worked out later on during the Second Boer War in South Africa, when the top military, or the acting military commander, William Francis Butler, was actually thought that the war was a very bad idea, both morally and practically. He recognized that the British were getting themselves into a disaster, but also thought that it was the wrong thing to be doing. And he quietly resigned. He kind of let his views be known, but when it was clear that he was just out of step, he wasn't ever publicly dismissed, but it was known that he was opposed to the war, and he was vilified in the popular press for being disloyal, even though he was trying to do the right thing, right, which is to prevent a war from happening. That was not acceptable to the British public. His was to not to reason why, his but to do or die, right? So this idea that reasoned discussion or principled opposition to a disastrous war was simply unacceptable, that I think is a very toxic virtue ideal.
Yeah, I think that's a really fantastic example. And I think that this, you know, what you kind of see through this sort of these creations of media within the empire, right, through whether it's poetry or journals or novels or whatever it might be, you know, as you kind of say, they reinforce these toxic virtues. And the example that you gave of the Light Brigade during the Crimean War was really great. And it made me think a little bit later of another example of during the age of Antarctic exploration with Robert Falcon Scott, where you had, you know, the kind of plucky Brit, you know, grit their teeth British team that was using poor tactics and poor, you know, organization and ended up all freezing to death on their mission. And instead of, you know, them being discredited or there being criticism, it became a moment to, you know, sort of celebrate the virtue of you know, gritting your teeth, of self-sacrifice, the virtue of, like, you know, like continuing on no matter what, even though, you know, when we look back on it now, it was just a lot of mistakes and errors that were mm-hmm. reconstrued into something else.
Yes, and going back to Brandon's earlier point about Aristotle and the way that Aristotle's view of the virtues has been so important to the virtue ethics tradition, I see this as one of the classic cases that Aristotle might have warned us about, right? That we shouldn't ever detach our virtue ideals from good judgment. And that's an error I think the Victorian virtue ideals did repeatedly. They had this idea about, particularly for military, but the idea that people would react even excessively sometimes in ways that were known to be a little bit dodgy in terms of the judgment, but that they valued the impetus behind it. And this idea that is something that Aristotle would be completely opposed to, that you, boldness is not the same as courage. True courage is knowing when to act, when not to, when to prioritize other values. It may be the moment for rushing in, waving your sword, but it might also be the moment for making peace. And that can be a courageous decision. Courage is knowing when, how much, why, to what extent. That's quite different than the kind of rashness or boldness that you can train for.
As a person whose background is like mostly philosophy, I do always get this experience reading history where you just get this sort of flood of interesting information, of empirical data about things that are happening, right? And I think that's exactly what Aristotle would be talking about in, you know, courage involving judgment, right? It's that part of the soul that encounters the contingent. And that's not something that philosophers are always kind of dealing with. And I think that's also something that we're seeing with these particular examples is very clear cases of things going wrong, or when you know the facts, you understand that they're just mistakes, or they're things just, you know, fell through the cracks. But then there is a construction around them about upholding an ideal that something like this can be repurposed for a virtue ideal. They're toxic almost initially, but then they're given a virtuous veneer afterwards as source material, right? And I also did want to kind of point to the open-endedness of this idea of the toxic virtue, because I think it, again, like, philosophers really like neat and tidy definitions. They like, you know, they like having a sentence that they can put in a philosophical dictionary. But I think by virtue of the fact that this is a historical analysis, the definition has to be left open, because in any kind of historical analysis, you can't know in advance what examples you're going to be supplied with from the historical data. History is necessarily contingent in that way, and so it's not going to be conducive of the investigation if you have some strict definition, and then, you know, you have a kind of meta-ethical field open up about what toxic virtues are. That's not going to be conducive of the historical analysis that actually constitutes the phenomena, right? So I think that you're absolutely right to restrain yourself from that project, and in lieu of that, supply the data that is necessary for actually illuminating the phenomena. And then we get a kind of, you know, as it were, like a family resemblance of what this looks like. The toxic virtues are going to look like something according to your particular example. And this one you've picked, you know, British imperialism, because of, you know, perhaps even like contingent reasons, things like the wealth of source material and your own interest in that. But it also leaves open the project of doing this in other areas, in other historical fields.
Rita, put your finger on one of the things I'm struggling with, this idea about using historical examples, because it does involve interpretation, right? So, yeah, I think with toxic, I'm relying on the fact that there's been a shift, that we can take these examples as pretty hard to argue with. There's an about face. Even the society itself it started to grit its teeth about some of these narratives that had been pretty accepted. And what I'm doing, I think, is looking for structural features, right? So this one about not allowing judgment, trying to detach virtues and treat from judgment and treating them as, in effect, temperaments or individual character traits that could be trained rotely. That's something that Aristotle was about. Taking virtues in isolation from one another, confusing cultural prejudices with virtues, that's Mill's mistake, right? Other mistakes like that, of a sort that you can say, okay, right, we can get some general lessons here. That's the hope, because, you know, that's the sort of thing you might be able to possibly feedback into your own value system and say, am I doing that here? Is there something to be learnt from this at a general level where we could perhaps see some carryover from looking at this one case where a society went wrong? Not to demonize our society, but to learn how we would diagnose our own mistakes and see, you know, are there patterns in error? Are there patterns in unproductive avenues, if you like, to explore for virtues? And I think one of them is restricting your virtue narrative to a particular group. So, for instance, a couple of the narratives, I look at Gilbert and Sullivan's operettas. I don't know if you've run across these yourself, but these were very popular and still are in Britain now, where there are songs about the common sailor, and songs that are trying to raise awareness of the humanity of the ordinary working people. You also see this in one of the painter that I look at, Elizabeth Thompson. She's a battle painter who was famous for actually drawing attention to the humanity of the ordinary rank and file soldier, but only the British soldier, only the British sailor. And what Gilbert and Sullivan in, I don't know if you know, A British Tar, it sometimes shows up in, there's some popular culture references in the Indiana Jones movies, and there's a Bart Simpson episode featuring some of these songs. So it's saying you should respect this guy because he's British. It sounds like it's well-intentioned, but it's exclusionary, right? It goes along with this idea that we shouldn't respect other soldiers who aren't British or other sailors from other societies, or, you know, and this is exactly the time when the racist dialogue is really getting traction. It may not have been Gilbert's intention. Using that particular kind of narrative is really problematic, I think, because it, you know, it's trying to include the working class in the virtue discourse. And, you know, that's still an argument that needs to be made. There's plenty of people at the time who just wrote them off as animals. But you can't do it in a way that makes it just about nationality. It really is not going to work. You know, some of the moves that may be contingent, it's in this time and place, people who are trying to make an argument for better treatment for sex workers. But the means that they're doing this are creating and perpetuating longer-term problems. And you know, it totally see the difficulty with changing the status of women, changing the status of working people, getting the humanitarian narrative to do some work for some of these despised groups within Britain. Absolutely virtuous intentions there, but there's dangers with doing it in a certain way. And yeah, that comes out of the peculiar contingency of the time. But I'm hoping there's lessons we can learn that kind of take away and that give us some sort of general morals.
I think that the capacity for, you might call it, ethical reflection and social reflection within this historical investigation is really obvious. And it's something that we can apply, as Brandon, as you were kind of hinting at, to other periods, but also it's maybe an awareness that we can bring to ourselves. There's this, through cultural discourse, through political discourse over the period, there's this buildup of this structure of ideals that sort of personify the empire and the people that participate in that. Also, with the end of the era, is it then that, in a sense, the First World War sort of breaks this kind of unsteady structure? You kind of have this, as we've kind of been hinting at or talking about, all these ideals and the structure built on anthropological mistakes and misunderstandings and power structures, and they get confronted by World War One, and it sort of is a trauma that the system can't take.
I started out thinking that World War One was a clean break, and I've both been a little bit persuaded to recognize that the Victorian values didn't completely go away. Certainly the consensus broke down. And I think there's kind of, it's not the first moment either. There's during the Crimean War, which is 1854 to 57, there's already real criticism of the leadership structure and the virtue narratives that supported that. During the Second World War, particularly this 1899 to 1902, if I'm getting my dates right, there's another kind of crisis when there's significant dissent and more questioning about the British superiority narrative. For instance, that's the first time that it was publicly acknowledged that the British were imprisoning civilians in effect, concentration camps. This was Kitchener, who was trying to control the civilian population because he recognized that the Boer fighters were simply going back to their farms. So he rounded up tens of thousands of women and children. He was also rounding up black African civilians at the same time, and they didn't get the same attention, but the public in Britain were outraged by the deaths among Boer civilians, and they actually sent out what was called a ladies' commission to go and investigate, because it was a middle-aged woman spinster who basically broke the story on this. So there's already some dissent and recognition that being British didn't guarantee being virtuous. And you know, this idea that the British somehow the defenders of freedom, that was starting to come into question. The Great War, as they call it, was a big turning point in confidence in the entire edifice. And that included the leadership structure, as well as also the virtue world, because these were really so closely tied together, right? They were university lecturers. Benjamin Jowett was teaching the youth that, the elite youth, that they were going to be like Plato's guardians when they were ruling India or administering India. And that's a really striking difference from the criticism of Plato as an authoritarian that comes up in the 20th century, you know, a real break in the acceptability of a certain kind of virtue narrative.
You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and we've been joined by Sylvia Berryman, a UBC professor focusing on toxic virtue in the British Empire.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, Simon Fraser University Campus Radio, streaming on the internet at www.cjsf.ca.
For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, aka SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of-action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.